Welcome to Scrappy ABM, your source for groundbreaking approaches that don't break the bank. ABM shouldn't cost $200K in tech to even get started. So if you want to get started with ABM or make your program even better without investing a massive amount of money, you're in the right place. Each week, we'll hear from the brightest minds in the marketing world who are redefining ABM, achieving incredible results with untraditional methods, limited resources, and a whole lot of creativity. This isn't a show about how much money you can spend on fancy tech or overhyped tools. Instead, it's about celebrating creative problem solving and the scrappiness it takes to get ABM right. We'll dive into how these marketing leaders built robust ABM strategies with limited resources, revealing the actionable insights that led to their biggest wins. So if you're a marketer ready to challenge the status quo and build a scalable, efficient, effective marketing strategy, Scrappy ABM is the show for you. So if you're ready to discover ABM strategies that are lean, impactful, and utterly transformative, let's dive into this episode. Hello and welcome to Scrappy ABM, your podcast with practical playbooks that don't break the bank. This is your host, Mason Cosby, and today I am joined by Dr. Jim, who is the VP of Growth over at Engage Rocket. I'm super pumped because, first of all, one, Jim, I love the neon sign, crazy neon, quick shout out. And then two, man, I'm excited because we're talking through a content-led outbound program that's married with market expansion, because Dr. Jim was tasked with, how do I take a company to the US? So I'm excited to dig into, like, how did you find even the right niche to focus in on in a new market? Like we talked about right before we pressed record, everybody has their hypothesis of like who we should be going after. So I'm excited to see how you validated that hypothesis, found the right audience, and then how you're doubling down in it. So Jim, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, I'm pumped to be on the show. I think it's going to be an interesting conversation, and it gives a pretty decent opportunity for me to kind of reflect back on what has happened over the last year. And, you know, I've always been sort of a pioneering mentality or mindset. So whenever we get an opportunity to tackle something new and break into new territory or new markets and do it in a way that's not standard or not the acceptable, quote unquote, acceptable playbook, it's always fun to see that come to life.
Heck yeah. Yeah, it was funny. I hosted the Marketing Ladder for a couple of years. Somebody told me that that show felt like career therapy. And I think Scrappy ABM is starting to become like ABM program therapy for reflecting and like figuring out what worked and what didn't and recounting the scars that you experienced along the way. So with that, I'd love to just understand super high level. Again, you're expanding into the US. So for starters, like why? Like why was US expansion even in the question?
Yeah. So when, to give you a little bit of context, Engage Rocket is a people analytics platform. And we're an eight-year-old company that has grown in the Asia Pacific region. And being a Singaporean company, there is a limited amount of footprint that you can grow in that region. So for you as an HR tech company, you really need to have a footprint in both Europe and the US, but primarily the US, to have any sort of significant traction. So it was a business decision to continue the growth. And the challenge is that, you know, our entire company is Singaporean based. And I'm in the US, and now my co-founder is in the, our co-founder is in the US as well. So how do you pull this off with a really thin US footprint, and how do you do it in a way where, you know, you're buried in a competitive landscape, you're competing for attention, nobody's picking up the phone, nobody responds to anything. How do you cut through all the noise and create space for you to have the conversations that you need to have to determine what's the pathway through, what's the niche that you need to be in, and how do you build traction? So those were like, and we're doing this in an economic landscape where things are highly uncertain. So we didn't pick the best time to make this call, but, you know, doing it, pulling it off during the toughest time, it builds you a set of capabilities that you can survive anything else after the fact.
Again, I love the call out of just like sometimes starting in the worst time. It's even, I've heard a lot of people say like, yeah, if you want to build a habit, do it when you're super busy, because if you do it when you're super busy, you'll stick with it, versus like, if you do it when you're free, when you get busy, you'll drop it. So if you can make it work in a really hard economic time, you can make it work in the best economic time. So again, very clear, like for lack of a word, you tapped out on the Singaporean market, and where was the next target-rich market? It was the U.S. So makes sense on that front. My question is then, like, as you were then expanding, again, no customers in the U.S., like, what was the theory or hypothesis of where you would find your customers as you expanded into the U.S.?
Yeah, and it's interesting because the normal playbook tells you that if you have an existing customer base, which we did, your first opportunity to expand into a new market is to find other business units in international markets that your existing customers have. That didn't exist. So we're coming into the U.S. market with zero customers, zero revenue in the U.S. market, and we have to make stuff happen. So as far as our theory into how we tackle the market, we knew that we weren't going to be doing the typical predictable revenue model approach, which is just smile and dial your way and spam your TAM your way into, you know, trying to get meetings and push a demo. We knew that wasn't going to work because it already wasn't working and hadn't been working for 4 or 5 years or maybe even longer. So we knew that wasn't going to work. We also knew, or at least my recommendation was, that we don't spend time chasing labels that people know. I mean, if opportunistically they end up on your radar from an inbound perspective, great. But we're not going to waste our time tracking these giant labels because it's going to be a time suck. So what we did was we did a loose framework of the typical customers that we have in Singapore, applied those concepts to the US, and then we broke everything down by industry and did 4 to 6 week sprints doing a content-led outbound motion to bring them into our ecosystem. So we could actually understand what's driving this market versus what we thought would be driving this market based on how Singaporean customers buy. Like, we have no idea how a US customer in HR tech looking for people analytics is going to buy, especially when we're the new kid on the block that nobody knows. So we needed to answer those questions and validate, is our product strong enough compared to what's out there to at least create a conversation? So that's, you know, kind of our approach is look for no-name labels, look for companies that look similar to what existed in our Singapore customer base, and apply not a sales-driven motion, but sort of a combination of a marketing-driven and product-driven motion where we're using sort of this perpetual discovery concept so we can actually learn what are the triggers that we need to leverage and pull so that we can actually move people down funnel.
Yeah, I mean, it really sounds like, again, creating content for the purpose of customer research so that you could build the relationship, understand what was and wasn't working, and just like really at the core say, like, can we play well here? And just ensure before we go invest a ton of money, can we?
So it's interesting that you mention that customer research motion. And when we were informing what our playbook looked like in the US, it was a combination of stuff that Andy Paul talks about and a combination of stuff that Ryan Paul Gibson talks about, where sellers naturally look at discovery as a stage. I've always looked at discovery as a process. And if we can embed discovery at all stages of the buyer journey and the sales process, we're better off, and we over-index on the front end of the sales cycle, that's going to actually get you better quality on the back end, and it's actually going to drive a lot of different levers at the same time. It's going to drive your marketing levers in terms of what your messaging should look like. It's going to drive your product levers in terms of where your product needs to be compared to what else is out there in the market. So we applied that customer research and product research mindset to all of our conversations, and it was all looped in or tied together with the intention of spotlighting practitioners in the field on their expertise about building high performance organizations. So we're creating the space where people want to talk to us. I think every seller that might be listening to this, and even some marketers might be listening to this, are probably sitting there thinking, nobody's returning my emails, nobody's returning my calls, and we, by executing this playbook, are having 60, 70% of the people that we reach out to booking meetings with like an 80, 90% show rate, and then multiple meetings after that, because you're focused on the relationship and you're disconnecting from the outcome. You're operating with a level of curiosity where you're trying to understand, where do we stack up? And if it's good, great. If it's bad, that's great too. You need to get to good or bad as quickly as possible. And that's what our intention was. And you're not going to do that. You're not going to accomplish that by spamming your TAM and by sending 10,000 emails asking about, hey, do you want to look at this cool thing that we built? Nobody cares about that.
And again, I want people to really hear, if you do the spam your TAM type approach, on average, the response rate, not even the meeting rate, the response rate is like 1-3%. So what Jim, you just said, on average, 60-70% booking rate for a meeting plus a 80-90% show rate. That is one of my favorite reasons behind podcasting, is it's essentially like one of the most guaranteed ways to book a meeting with anybody you want to talk to.
And here's where I think a lot of folks go wrong trying to leverage, and it just does, it doesn't necessarily have to be podcast driven. You know, I call it content led growth. And what you have to center yourself around is making the person that you're reaching out to the star or the hero of their story. And where sellers go wrong is that they think they're the hero of the story. They get these meetings and then they turn it into a glorified pitch session, which is not what you're supposed to do. If you do that, you burn the relationship. So, you know, it's Josh Braun often says, yeah, don't fight the resistance, join the resistance. Use jujitsu principles and apply it across your entire revenue funnel. And that's what you do, is that you're operating from a place of genuine curiosity. And that's got to come through in every step or every interaction that you have with your buyer. And that keeps them coming back and giving and them agreeing to spend more time with you. Like, to put it into terms that everybody can understand, that first meeting is usually a 45-minute meeting with me. Then you have a content recording or collaboration session. That's usually another 45 minutes to an hour. And then you have additional product research. That's another 45 minutes to an hour. So by the time somebody enters our funnel, they've probably, that one prospect has probably spent 4 to 6 hours with me before they're actually opened as an opportunity. Like, this is when I talk about, if you want to be a highly effective seller, you need to over-index to the front end of your buying process or buyer's journey and overload there so you can be faster on the back end. But instead, what most sales organizations or sales leaders do is that they say, well, let's push people through the various stages of the sales funnel as fast as we can. And that's fundamentally at odds with how you apply this content-led growth approach, this content collaboration approach, because you're operating under what's important to you instead of what's important to the buyer.
So many good things just to pull out around. Again, when we think through however you want to create the content, but it's just the sheer number of touch points. I mean, we keep hearing this idea that it takes, what is it like now? It feels like it's like probably up to 21 touch points for somebody's willing to buy. But like, I love what Todd Capone said one time when we were talking through it. He goes, why does it take that many? Like, why can't it just be like 2 or 3 really intentional good touch points before somebody's open to being an opportunity? Like, it shouldn't take 21 or 18 or whatever the number is now. It takes that many because your touches are probably pretty crappy and they're not intentional and they're not well thought out. Like, if you really stood out and said something that was helpful and impactful, you'd have a much easier time actually creating an opportunity.
And that's a fantastic point that you make up. And I agree with Todd that it should be just a handful of very meaningful and intentional touch points that move the needle for you. But your point about the reason why it's 21 or 31 or 51, might as well be a million, is because everybody is just trying to beat their buyer over the head into submission to taking a meeting. And you're not being relevant. You're not being timely. You're not really serving any agenda other than your own. And people can sense that even through an email. So I think one of the big problems that comes out of this approach is that sales leaders are pounding to their teams, oh, you need 500 accounts in your territory that you need to be messaging over a period of time. You need to be whatever, pick arbitrary big number and arbitrary big contact. That's what you need in your territory to be successful. I've always taken the opposite approach, and it's been applied at Engage Rocket. It's been applied at all of my previous roles for like the past 10 years has been a variation of this approach, but it's been be highly targeted, have a small roster of named accounts that you're targeting. And when I say small, I'm saying 50, and you hit those 50 accounts over the course of a quarter. And if you want to shorten it, you can do it, you know, 50 accounts a month or whatever, but I'd like a quarter, because the focus is get as much quality within a segment or a set of named accounts so you actually understand where that person sits and you can quickly prioritize them across to into short, medium, and long-term opportunities. And now you've built a perpetual sort of funnel that you can cycle through. But what happens is that, you know, reps are handling 200, 300 accounts and you never get critical mass within any of those accounts. So you're just relegated into the noise category. And you're not getting intel at a pace that's fast enough for you to be meaningful to drive bottom of the funnel revenue. You're just spread too thin.
Yeah, I mean, again, I love the call out of why are we having sellers focus on 500 accounts in a territory or 300 or wherever that number is. Like, sales is the most expensive marketing channel of all time. Marketing should be building the awareness and the affinity. And then sales should be super personalized in its nature. So again, I always love talking with you because I feel like we come at it from the different angles, but we kind of end up in the same spot, which is like, how do we help sellers be more personalized in their outreach to build actual relationships that result in revenue, or if not revenue, at least insights on how to generate new revenue from other people?
Yeah, the insights part is important. And I think, and that should be the emphasis. It's, you know, if you have a big enough organization where you have the marketing muscle, where you're getting a ton of inbound and people are, you know, further along in the funnel when they reach sales, then that's a great situation to be in. That's not where we were. You know, basically when we opened the US market, our co-founder was actually trying to tap the market for 6-8 months with limited traction before I came on board. And then we put this playbook in place. And the intention was to understand what is the market looking for, what's important here, what are the segments that we might have an opportunity in. And we took a very focused approach, but first with the intention of just creating conversations and meaningful conversations. That was our first goal. If your outreach is tied around how many meetings can I get to drive opportunities, you're already off on the wrong mindset. So you have to have the right underlying motivations for why you're doing it. And if you're not oriented in a way to just understand what your buyers care about, you're going to spend a lot of time and not get anywhere.
Okay. Last couple of questions, because again, I think you've outlined a really simple but a highly effective playbook of, if you're going into new markets, like, just build great relationships with the people that you want to be your buyers, to understand where you sit in the market, where you sit in their minds, and understanding what's important to them. And then while you build that relationship, obviously, like, there are natural things that come up over the course of the conversation, or you could be like Dr. Gemini and have neon signs that tell a little bit about who we are. And, you know, branding is pretty helpful on that front. But all that to say, through that, you inevitably I'll have some that turn into pipeline, some that don't, and that's okay. My last couple of questions for you would just be, as you're building this, like, what were some of the unexpected roadblocks that kind of came up along the way?
I mean, I think the biggest roadblock was just about everything that we assumed was a good theory wasn't a good theory. And a perfect example would be this. You know, a good cross-section of the companies that we have as existing customers in Singapore happen to be in HR or HR-related functions, so HR tech sort of organizations. So one of our theories was, when we come into the US, well, let's target that segment and look at tech the tech sector first and the HR buyer in the tech sector first, because that looked similar to who the buyer was in our native market. Well, what ended up happening was that we would get HR buyers to a certain point, but it would stall out because there wasn't enough of an urgency on their plate to drive responses or drive urgency on what we particularly do. So we started experimenting with, well, maybe we need to focus on the stakeholder that has the pain. So sales leaders, IT leaders typically deal with a lot of the pain that we solve for. And the challenge was if we go in through that route, it gets relegated into the HR space as something for HR to solve with very little buy-in. So two of those theories didn't pan out. So what we did was started looking at, okay, what is the main thing that we're solving for? The main thing that we help solve for are rampant turnover and culture and morale issues. So what are the industries that have that issue across the board that it doesn't matter what our entry point is, we're going to get an audience because this is something that's just burning money within their organization. So that was the big learning that we figured out. And one of the things that I always like to say, and I should have known this in the beginning, you can have all the theories in the world about how something's going to happen until you actually start executing on the outbound side of it. Your theories don't mean crap. Your theories are worthless. So the quicker that you can get out and start talking to customers, the better off that you'll be. And this is where a content-led approach is really meaningful, because you're hearing straight from your buyers what's important, what's not important, how they buy, why they buy, versus some cooked up theory that you have in your head that probably isn't based in any reality given the market that you're entering into. Because the quicker that you admit that you don't know anything about anything, the better off you'll be. And that's where everybody needs to be centered. You don't know anything, so go and ask and listen. Don't talk, listen. Thank you for attending my TED Talk.
I was about to say, anytime you go to build an ABM program or anything, just immediately parking your assumptions at the door. I love having good hypotheses and theories, but not holding them so tightly that you're like, this is a fact. Like, this is how it's going to go. Like, actually treating it like a hypothesis or a theory that is the purpose is to test and to validate, not to come in with the assumption that this is true and correct. And then how do we do everything in our power to hold that tightly? So, Dr. Jim, again, always, I love it. If people want to find more from you and learn more from you, where can they find you?
So you can find me in a couple of different places. Obviously, LinkedIn is easy to find. You can get to me via cascadingleadership.com, or you can email me at jim.k@engagerocket.co. A lot of different ways to get in touch with me.
Again, Jim, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been Scrappy AVM, and we'll see you in the next one. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Scrappy ABM. If you enjoyed this week's episode, go ahead and give us a follow so that you don't miss a single episode. We drop every single Monday so that you can start your week off right. And if you're looking for additional great content just like this, go check out scrappyabm.com. We're building a library of frameworks, guides, templates, processes, and tools so you have everything that you need to build a low-budget, high-impact, scrappy program. Again, thank you for listening to this episode of Scrappy ABM. This has been your host, Mason Cosby, and we look forward to seeing you in the next one.